TNT Radio wants you to get on our soapbox because your opinion matters. Tell us what you really think at tntradio.live. Upload a video, some audio, or drop us a note on TNT Radio's soapbox, lighting the fuse for freedom. Today's news talk, TNT Radio. This is Jesse Zurawell and Perspective on today's news talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome to Perspective. I am Jesse Zurawell, your host for the hour. And today I have the distinct pleasure of being joined by none other than Hedley Reese. Hedley is a managing consultant at PharmaFlow, which is a UK-based consultancy specializing in drug development and commercialization. Before his position at PharmaFlow, Hedley held senior positions at Bayer UK, British Biotech, Vernalis, Ortho Clinical Diagnostics, and Astellas. He is the author of a book titled Supply Chain Management in the Drug Industry, Delivering Patient Value for Pharmaceuticals and Biologics. And as per his bio on trialsitenews.com, where you can find many articles he's published, Hedley is a zealous advocate of radical reform in healthcare and the pharmaceutical industry. Hedley, welcome to Perspective. Thank you very much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Jesse. It's a real pleasure to speak to you. So I'm looking forward to it.
Yes, me too. There's much to get into. I want to start with a conversation you recently had on UK Column. You had this conversation along with your colleague, Sasha Latipova, who's been a guest on this program. And she revealed some information during that conversation, which she revealed to me on this program the last time we spoke. And if I can summarize, essentially what she revealed was that the regulatory agencies in the US and in the UK and in the EU, the pharmaceutical and medical regulatory agencies, which are supposed to be conducting pharmacovigilance with regard to the COVID-19 injections and all other biologics and medicines, essentially these agencies, these bodies are under no contractual obligation to fulfill their role because these COVID-19 injections, at least the mRNA-based ones, are U.S. Department of Defense products, and the U.S. Department of Defense owns these products until they are injected into human beings. It seemed during that conversation that that was news to you. It was certainly news to me. So my first question to you is, upon learning that, how has that changed your understanding of what's been going on for almost 2 years now with regard to these COVID-19 injections, specifically the mRNA-based ones?
Well, I think what I'd say, what we I don't know if you have it in the US, but we have something called the Highway Code for people who drive. All drivers have to take a test, and they have to follow the rules of the road, the rules that have been devised to keep drivers and people safe. And what we've had here is that the rules of the road, the Highway Code, has been totally ignored. So by definition, you're going to have accidents, you're going to have problems, issues, and you're basically guaranteed to kill people. You know, if you let people, particularly so young sort of drivers who like to test out the speed of their cars, if you let them drive unhindered, then they're going to knock people over and the whole thing. So that's what we've got. And, you know, I was brought up, if you like, I joined Bayer in 1980. And in those days, the industry was totally integrated. So the big pharma companies owned all the facilities. They employed just about all the people And they were the child captains of the supply chains from start to finish. Now, 40 years later, everything's outsourced by Big Pharma. They don't own any of the facilities, any of the people. All they do is patent molecules and sell the products when they are eventually approved. And very few do get approved. So the issue I have is we've got to the point here where by Big Pharma, having done all the outsourcing, is now not able to develop drugs itself. And, you know, it's outsourced it to the contract supply, the contract base, which was contract development and manufacturing organizations and contract research organizations. Now, many people listening will be familiar with some of those titles, some won't. But if we talk about someone like Brooke Jackson, who worked for a site management organization, that site management organization was employed by a contract research organization. Ventavia. Now, they don't actually, it's delegated responsibility, but still, the company selling the products, this is Pfizer and Moderna, still hold responsibility for the actions of the contractors. But it seems that there's the waters have become so murky that no one actually knows who's looking after what. So there's, you know, no control in the whole thing. So I don't know if that helps, Jesse. I just wanted to get that out there because many people don't understand the extent to which the big pharma companies have just handed off development and manufacture of drugs to third parties, and they don't have the responsibility really to keep them safe.
Yes, that's very helpful. And it's important to bring this up again and again because not a lot of people are aware of this yet. And as many people as possible need to be made aware of this, especially those who are trying to take the FDA to task, the MHRA to task, the EMA, European Medicines Agency, to task, because essentially what they're doing is barking up the wrong tree. At least that's the way I perceive it. Would you agree with that?
I do. And I think what's happened here is that I'd say this now, but there is an organization that seems to have appointed itself called the International Coalition for Medicines Regulatory Authorities. It's sort of unofficial. The regulators are known as competent authorities, so they have delegated authority from governments to regulate medicines. So they have to license medicines, they have to inspect the facilities, they have to have a full inspection capability, and they have to ensure that pharmacovigilance is carried out. But pharmacovigilance is the responsibility of the company selling the products, not the regulators. Their responsibility is to make sure it's being carried out. So all this VAERS reporting and the yellow card in the MHRA, actually, it's the Pfizers and the Modernas who should be collecting that information and acting on it. And by now, they should have stopped those jabs, you know, well, months, if not years ago. So the waters have been muddy because this organization, I've got the link to it, but it was set up in 2016 by Dr. Ian Hudson, who was then the chief executive of the MHRA, and he was the initial chair. And over the last, or since the 2016, the next chair was the head of the European Medicines Agency, and the current chair is the head of the European Medicines Agency. Now, this body has all the regulatory bodies in the world as members. And Dr. Ian Hudson now works for the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And I just wonder then how sort of objective and what their role actually is. And I think what's happened, bodies like the CDC and in the UK, the joint the vaccine committees, they have watered down the competent authorities' responsibility for the proven drugs. So FDA has been sort of watered down by the other bodies, the committees that have been involved. So the decision-making is not based on true understanding of the science, and not just the science, but the way the industry works. And it's the same in the UK. We have these bodies who are, you know, a part of the approval process for these jabs that really aren't qualified to do that. So what I'm saying is that I think these the official, what I call the official regulatory bodies with delegated responsibility from governments have been captured and their powers have been diluted. And so because people have so little understanding of how the industry works, because, you know, the pharma industry basically works and under the radar, they aren't able to ask the searching questions as to, you know, what actually is going on. Does that help?
Yes, absolutely. I wonder too, with the increasing merging of pharmaceutical entities, especially the giants like Pfizer, BioNTech, Moderna, Johnson & Johnson, the increasing merging of those entities with the regulatory bodies that are supposed to hold them to account. I wonder if, because of that increasing merging, there's been an acceleration of this watering down, this murkiness you speak of. Because when I think of the FDA now, and I think of Pfizer, BioNTech as an example, I essentially think of them as the same entity. They're so incestuous, if you will, that it's difficult, if not impossible, to identify where one stops and the other begins. They become so convolved. And to me, that certainly adds to this problem we're talking about. And this is a problem which has allowed these toxic injections not only to be rolled out globally, but to see new iterations developed that have no testing, no human testing behind them, barely any animal testing behind them. Not to mention the fact that these injections are clinically worthless. And even if you subscribe to viral contagion, they don't work. They were and remain doomed on first principle if you get into the technology of mRNA and gene therapy, as it's called, although I think therapy is quite a generous term. So basically what I'm asking is there any difference at this point between the pharmaceutical industries and the bodies that are supposed to be regulating them? Because it seems to me that that distinction disappeared a long time ago.
Yes, good question. Well, for certain, with the MHRA in the UK, all the good people have left. I mean, I co-chaired a conference in Cincinnati which was FDA sponsored and co-sponsored by Xavier University. I co-chaired that for 3 years. I spoke the first year from 2010 to 2013. And in those days, there was a lot of concern about outsourcing. There'd been a very damaging incident, well, tragic incident with heparin, where people had died and many people had had adverse reactions. And it was because an illicit substance had been substituted for the original product with heparin. It was 100 times cheaper, and it killed people and maimed people. And that was the first time that people realized this outsourcing has taken away the transparency, the visibility in supply chains. And it was very difficult to pick up when bad actors were doing things that for economic benefit that could have killed patients. And the conference, it was called the Global Outsourcing Conference. And it began because of these issues. And it was supposed to be a dialogue between the industry, the regulators, and the contract manufacturers. And over those years, it was successful. But since that, things have really gone backwards. And what I'm saying is, in those days, FDA were really on top of it. The pre-approval manager for Cincinnati District, Kathleen Culver, every year she used to come out with these horrific stories of a company that as a contract manufacturer had been made to do things that they didn't want to do against the regulations because the sponsor just wanted to get the drug approved and get it moving on. And in those days, FDA really was a really, you know, doing its job. And I've been emailing, having email exchanges with Dr. Janet Woodcock at FDA since 2011, when I wrote the book that you mentioned there, Jesse. And she's been a modernizing force in the industry since, you know, the late 1990s. It's just, there's in the last, I'll say, 4 to 6 years, the regulators have been captured by whatever's doing it. And, you know, certainly this International Coalition of Medical Regulatory Authorities seems to be part of it. And so now we know MHRA is a shell organization. All the good people have gone. The MHRA was not doing drug approvals from 1995 onwards, because that moved to the European Medicines Agency in the UK on Canary Wharf in London, but it was a different organization. That's now moved to Holland. The European Medicines Agency has moved to Holland. So all the skills evaluating drugs have gone to Holland, and MHRA has lost all those skills. So you wonder how they were able to approve. They were the first in the world to approve the Pfizer vaccine when they don't have the skills or the ability to do the evaluation work to evaluate the safety module, the clinical module, and the important module, which is the chemistry, manufacturing, and controls module, which is effectively the supply chain. People forget that safety is heavily dependent on the supply chain meeting its regulatory obligations, because what the patient gets administered to them is the product of the supply chain. So there's nothing in between. So if there's any error in the supply chain, then that's going to feed straight into patient safety. And that's been ignored. The safety has been carried out on early stage clinical trials, but no further studies have been carried out as the supply chain has scaled up. And now the scale is enormous.
Mm-hmm. And in the case of these mRNA injections, we're talking about very volatile compounds that need to be kept frozen and thawed according to certain stipulations. And this is in no way to suggest that even if those protocols are followed, that these injections are safe. They are absolutely poisonous as far as I'm concerned. And I think that there's plenty of empirical evidence to back that up. But ostensibly, there are supposed to be rigorous protocols followed with regard to freezing and thawing. And that goes for when they're being transported to injection sites, places where injections are administered. And that goes for when they're being stored at those sites as well. And I've read through a lot of these protocols, which are different for different injections. So Pfizer's injection, which is mRNA based, has a different protocol than Johnson & Johnson's, which is adenovirus vector based, DNA based, essentially. And I can't imagine that these protocols, just reading them is complicated. I can't imagine that actually following them, putting them into practice responsibly to the T is, maybe it's being done somewhere, but I doubt it's being done anywhere. So what that's doing is just adding to the toxicity that's already inherent in these injections. I wonder what you have to say to that.
Yeah. Well, the first thing to say is that these injections are biologics. So they're made from living things. So they're very sensitive to the environment, particularly changes in temperature. That's why we have the cold chain element in there. Now, biologics are an order of magnitude more difficult to manufacture than small molecule products. That's products made by industrial chemistry, you know, aspirin, paracetamol, those sorts of things. An order of magnitude more difficult. And the supply chain has to be, and the temperature in the supply chain has to be managed through every stage, every transfer. And if we think of biosimilars is the term used for copies of biologics. So something like Herceptin, which is a monoclonal antibody, that's a biologic. Anyone who's going to make a copy of it has to prove interchangeability. It has to prove that their product is interchangeable with the reference product. Now, that's incredibly difficult because biologics are so changeable, so variable. And that's why we don't see many biosimilars come to market, not in the same way as with generic small molecule drugs, where, you know, there's been a real improvement in cost and the whole thing with small molecule drugs, because they're relatively simple. They've got long shelf lives. The technology transfer is fairly simple. But with biologics, it's different. The manufacturing, every site makes a different, even if the process looks the same, the clinical impact of the product is going to be different. So that's why you have to be so careful that you've got interchangeability. So the evidence there is that there are so few biosimilars coming to market. These are copies. Then how can we suddenly be taking all these biologics, mixing and matching, and not testing to make sure that this one's the same as the other one? That's the one thing with these being biologics. The other thing is these DNA vaccines have been under development for 25 years, you know, and they were finding that the animal models were just not predictive of what was going to happen in humans. And up until 3 years ago, that was still the case. You know, these mRNA was just and the adenovirus vaccines were just a question mark. You know, how do we ever get these developed? And suddenly over with the COVID crisis, suddenly we've got more mRNA products than you could shake a stick at. And you look at the number of companies now who are delving into mRNA, but, you know, it's a theory. And, you know, when you have to manufacture something, you have to be pretty damn sure that you've got all the boxes ticked, you've got all your components properly lined up, they've been properly validated and checked out, then you've got all your suppliers to be checked out, you've got all the specifications and the validation of processes at each stage. So, and then we go to, even for the small molecule product, the US Government Accountability Office in 2006 wrote a report which basically said it takes about 11 and a half years to get a product to market, 3 years for the preclinical testing, 7 years for the clinical work, 1.5 years to assess the for the FDA or the ready to assess the application, and then you get the approval. So how can we suddenly develop these drugs in less than 12 months? You know, and the Government Accountability Office, you know, they are gold standard when it comes to analysis. So mm-hmm. you have to say that this, at first, when this first came out, to me, any drug developed in less than 8 years, say, would have to be a huge question mark. Mm-hmm. And there may be ways they can do it, but money isn't going to change the need for the process. First of all, to go through safety testing, and that's testing in animals. And when you do those tests, you have to manufacture the product in small scale, 10 to 15 kilos, 10 to 15 liters. You then have to send that off to a contract research organization that specializes in animal testing. They administer what you've made to animals. They write a report. You get the report back. And then it either says, yes, you know, this is safe enough to go into phase one safety studies in humans, or no, it's not safe. And the other work you have to do is what they call the drug metabolism and pharmacokinetics of the drug, what in animals, what the drug does to the animal's body and what the animal's body does to the drug. Because again, a body, you know, a human or animal body does things to a drug, which it could break it down so that that becomes toxic. So it needs at least 3 years to do all that work. Before then, you can go into a phase one study in humans. And this whole talk about rolling reviews is complete nonsense, because you can't do phase one, phase two, and phase three all together. If mm-hmm. you could, hallelujah, you know, people would be doing it. But you have to prove safety in healthy volunteers first. And you have to prove that the drug that they've been is been administered that to them has gone through safety testing. And then when you go into phase two and phase three studies where you make more drug, that has to be safety tested again. So it has to be done in series. It cannot be done in parallel. But yet that's what they've claimed they've done with these vaccines, which is nonsense. Mm-hmm.
Yes, absolutely. Nonsense, to say the least. And it's global, what is happening, what you just described. So it's not happening solely with the mRNA injections in Western countries. This is happening in countries like Russia and China, for example. So Russia was the first to bring a so-called COVID-19 vaccine to public use, the first country to develop one and use it on its public, Sputnik V. And it developed this in concert with Oxford AstraZeneca. So it's an adenovirus vector injection, a DNA injection. And if you look at the so-called trials that this went through. So this was officially released in August of 2020. So developed in, if we want to start from January of that year, 7 months. But I don't know exactly when the concoction process was started. If you look at the trial data, the limited trial data that's available for that, exactly what you just described happened, these sort of rolling trials. So phase one, phase two, phase three, almost simultaneously. And it's provided really nothing in the way of evidence of safety of these injections. I don't think they could ever be safe anyway, but the point being that these were rolled out super quickly in Russia, and in January of this year, Russia did away with the only signal system it had in place looking at harm and death caused by these injections. So there's no safety signal system in place in Russia now whatsoever with regard to these. So it's impossible to know exactly, or as exactly as one can from a system like VAERS or the yellow card scheme, who is being injured and killed by these injections and how many people are being injured and killed by them. China, at the same time, it started with its own adenovirus vector injection, but last week it announced that its first mRNA injection to receive emergency use approval received emergency use approval in Indonesia. So it's going to be tested on Indonesians before Chinese citizens. And according to CGTN, which is a Chinese state news outlet, quote, "It's now ready for public use after 3 years of development and clinical trials," unquote. So this one only went through 3 years of development and clinical trials, whatever those entailed. Also very interesting that this was announced on November 15th. So 3 years from November 15th, if you go back, is November of 2019. So I have some questions about, if that's true, why were these injections being developed in November 2019, well before the official rollout of this COVID-19 operation? But my point in bringing this up is that, one, this is being done globally, and two, China is moving into the mRNA technology, as it were, and so is Russia. Russia is doing so at the same time. I've collected many articles from Russian language media on this, and they're going through extremely expedited trials, if you can even call them trials. So this madness that we've seen for almost 2 years now with regard to these injections is not just continuing, it's accelerating, and all sorts of iterations of these injections are being developed. When you look, and this is the last thing I'll say before I ask for your comment, when you look at the EMA's risk management plan for Pfizer-BioNTech's Comirnaty injection, which is the one that's touted to have received FDA approval, not just emergency use authorization, but FDA approval, which still isn't available for some reason in the US, which is, I would say, a good thing, although it is being used in other parts of the world. When you look at their risk management plan, which was updated this month, November 2022, to include not just the original iteration BNT162B2, but it now includes BNT162B2BA.1 and BNT162B2BA.4 and 0.5. So these bivalent versions. If you look at table 58 on page 105 of this risk management plan, Table 58 is summary of safety concerns. And it identifies important potential risks as vaccine-associated enhanced disease, VAED, including vaccine-associated enhanced respiratory disease, VAERD. And then it identifies missing information. And this information has been missing since the very beginning. Use in pregnancy and while breastfeeding, use in immunocompromised patients, use in frail patients with comorbidities, e.g. chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD, diabetes, chronic neurological disease, cardiovascular disorders, use in patients with autoimmune or inflammatory disorders, interaction with other vaccines, and last but not least, long-term safety data. So you brought up the biosimilars and the mix and match. There's still no information according to this document. And I checked it against other documents and the safety concerns, as they're put, are the same. There's no information on interaction with other vaccines, including the flu injection. And there is still no long-term safety data, yet these concoctions, they keep coming despite the plethora of signals out there that they are both harmful and lethal. So I know I put a lot of information out there, but I'd like to get your response to that, given your vast experience with these products and the supply chain and what theoretically at this point should be done.
Yeah, well, I think the first thing to say is that there are a lot of people hoping to make a lot of money out of mRNA. If we look at the UK government and the UK in general, they are seeing mRNA as the next big growth area for life sciences, as they're hoping to become number one in the world. We've got the cell and gene therapy catapult, which has a role of growing what we call advanced therapies, the cell and gene therapy, but most of it is gene therapy. And what a lot of people don't know is that in the UK, a company called Oxford Biomedica actually make the adenovirus for AstraZeneca. Neither AstraZeneca nor Oxford University had anything to do with the development, other than sort of handing over some code, with the development and manufacture of the adenovirus vaccine that was Oxford Biomedica. But they also make the lentiviral vector for Novartis's Kymriah, which is a gene therapy for blood cancers. And the side effect warnings on that are quite swinging, and they refer to cytokine release syndrome as being a very serious side effect, and neurological toxicities. Now, mm-hmm. that's not too far away from the side effects that we're seeing with these vaccines, both the adenovirus and the mRNA. And I just asked the question, who is looking at that and who is saying, well, if this product on the market has got these side effects, and if you do an internet search on Kymriah, you will see on the FDA website, you will see the side effects, and you know, almost all patients get those side effects to some extent. So we have to ask ourselves the question, why are we using a viral vector type delivery system where we know there are severe side effects involved in vaccines? You know, it's mm-hmm. something that should, and I think has to be investigated, because there's a lot of patients, or there are patients on those gene therapy treatments, and we should be sure that they're properly looked after with in the hospital, so that they're not exposed to some of these side effects. Right. So I'd say that. So, and the whole world is seeing mRNA as the next big, you know, the next big opportunity. When Pfizer can make $80 billion in a year, or however much it was, And even the suppliers, the service providers, they're all part of this. They're all rubbing their hands and saying, oh, gosh, we're going to make a fortune. What they don't realize is mRNA is just a theory. It's a theory that hasn't been proven in practice. Well, you know, the practice of it so far has proven that it's a dangerous therapy. So, you know, we should stop immediately and, excuse me, and, you know, really take a rate check.
Yes. Maybe a permanent rain check would be in order. Yes. I want to point out that you have a Substack, hedleyreese.substack.com. That's hedleyreese.substack.com. And what you were just talking about, you detailed in, I believe it's your most recent piece titled, NHS is not just playing with fire, it's lighting them, all part of the harebrained plan. And in this piece, you go into the UK's quest, as you put it, to conquer the world with gene therapy. You talk about advanced therapy treatment centers, or ATTC, and this full-on pursuit by the UK to, as you say, make it a center of gene therapy. And I use the term therapy with a lot of reservation, because therapy invokes something therapeutic, something beneficial. And I take issue with the argument that there's anything therapeutic or beneficial going on with these concoctions. But for the sake of conversation, for the sake of this conversation, gene therapy is something both developmentally and administratively that the UK seems to be wanting to become a center of. And it makes me wonder, though, with all of the other countries out there pursuing this and setting up their own hubs, if you will, of production and administration, despite all of the safety signals we have with regard to harm and death, it makes me wonder if there's more going on here than just making money, if there is something going on with regard to genetic programming of human beings, because you have these bivalent injections, which are wrongly called boosters much of the time. They're actually new formulations. You have these continuing to be pushed. And if you look at the pipelines of Moderna and Pfizer, they have many, many more mRNA-based injections in the works, going through trials at different stages at this point. It's frightening to look at. But the uptake of these injections has decreased significantly, which is a very good thing. But they keep going with this, and they keep trying to push them. So I suspect there's something with genetic engineering that's going on. And I suspect this also plays into setting up the WHO ultimately as a world regulatory authority that dispenses with the need for nation state regulatory authorities like the FDA or the MHRA or the EMA. It's speculation. It's a theory for me at this point, but I argue there's a lot of evidence pointing in that direction. And here's the last thing I'll say before I ask for your response. Jeffrey Sachs, who is the Lancet's head of COVID-19 information, that's not his official title, but I'm paraphrasing what it is. He's really been harping on gain of function lately, which is been getting a lot of attention, not just in alternative media, but corporate media as well. I like to refer to it as gain of fiction, but nonetheless, it's been getting a lot of attention. And he's argued in The Lancet that this is why, this is a big reason why labs, biosafety labs, need to be more tightly regulated. And who better to do that than the WHO for this global governance body to come in and regulate these labs and by extension regulate the rest of this program we've seen rolled out over the past 2 years. I'm connecting dots. Again, it's a theory, but I see a lot of evidence pointing in that direction. So I'd like to get your response to that, what you're seeing.
Well, the WHO is another self-appointed body that's got no legitimacy whatsoever. I've seen, since about 2016, I've heard the WHO come up and come up, and they've written these papers, and they've actually duplicated. They've got their own GMP. They've duplicated the GMPs. The International Conference for Harmonization of Technical Requirements of Pharmaceutical Products, the ICH, have harmonized regulations globally. Nothing needed harmonizing. FDA, European Medicines Agency, and the Japanese regulators all signed up to the same common technical document when you apply for a new drug. The WHO basically don't add anything at all. And in fact, you know, you've got this organization, this duplicate regulatory organization, and the WHO is the duplicate organization as well. It just muddies the water, and it means that patients aren't safe. They don't have the skills. You know, you need the supply chain skills for the start. You know, you look at FDA, their inspectors are used to going out into supply chains, inspecting facilities. They know what it's like to make physical products and to find the people who are doing the things they shouldn't be doing. You know, I've seen the FDA in their uniforms with their guns on their, you know, on their hips. And because ultimately they've got the power to go in and enforce companies that are potentially going to kill people through their bad practices. And I've seen all that go now because, you know, these organizations like the WHO, they're self-appointed, and you know, it's just not helpful. So, and mRNA, you know, it can never work. You know, I keep saying drugs mm-hmm. are manufactured in factories, and any mistake is going to kill people potentially. And you can't have a theory about how a drug will work and suddenly manufacture it in 9 months or 12 months and, you know, believe it's going to work. It's a nonsense.
Yes. Yes. Nonsense, again, to say the least. Insanity, I think, is more appropriate.
Yes.
But again, these entities which have jumped on this, and perhaps jumped on this is not the right term, because they've been very interested in so-called mRNA technology for many, many years, as you've pointed out many times. And Moderna, for example, never successfully brought a product to market before its COVID-19 injection. And then lo and behold, here's this one at the perfect time that is sold to the public worldwide as safe and effective. We know it's neither. But you also bring up a good point. You've brought it up several times throughout this conversation that mRNA is a theory at best. And I think upon closer scrutiny, it's a failed theory up until this point. If you look at the literature all the way up until 2021, mRNA encapsulated in lipid nanoparticles has never been demonstrated to be able to enter human cells, and in the case of the COVID-19 injections, create a spike protein. So what's happening, and this is to the best of my knowledge, is that these lipid nanoparticles with mRNA in them are being injected in huge volumes into the body. They're distributed all over the body, as the Japanese study has shown us, collecting mostly in the ovaries, in women, in the spleen. And it's the mRNA itself, the modified messenger RNA, the modified is key there, that is poisoning and killing people. And this goes back to what you've been saying, that this is based on a theory, a failed theory that doctors like Michael Palmer, for example, have pointed out. If you look at this theory on first principle, there's no way it could possibly work. So it's a mess what we're dealing with. And we've seen the results of that on the human population worldwide. We have a minute left. Is there anything you'd like to leave us with?
Well, I just thought you mentioned Moderna. Moderna have outsourced the whole thing to the drug substance is made by a company called Lonza. Lonza, the biggest contract manufacturer in the world. And Catalent Biopharma Solutions do the fill finish, and that's public domain through press releases. So what I'm saying is the whole outsourcing over 40 years by Big Pharma means they don't have controls over the supply chains, and the others, the third parties, don't have any obligation other than to provide a fee for service. So to me, that is the real big issue here. Pharma's not been able to make money because it's not been bringing products to market. It looks at rare diseases. It looks at awful indication. It looks at anything cancer. But nothing really is coming to market. And this is the last ditch attempt to make blockbuster revenues. And it's completely fraudulent. And it's killing people. So, you know, I leave it there.
Well, Hedley, excellent warning. And thank you very much again for taking the time to speak with me. I'd love to continue this conversation at a future point. There's so much more we can get into, and I hope you'll rejoin me. But thank you again.
You're very welcome, Jesse. I've enjoyed it, and thank you very much.